the theme for the afternoon talk is the power to say no. But before I begin, I just want to ask a question. It frankly has got nothing whatsoever to do with the talk, but I am a little curious. How many people in here have been to India? I'd like to put your hands up. Nice. We'll see the rest of you later in the year there. or I could say, what have the rest of you been doing for all of your life? All right. As many of you know, both those of you who have been to India and those who haven't or have given thought to it, sometimes people say, oh, Christopher, I've never been to India. So then I say, well, go. Just go. And then the person will say, oh, just, I've been waiting for somebody to invite me for years. So I'm giving an invitation here to all of you. And though, before I will get back to the talk, I promise. I read in one of the Indian newspapers that last year around 85,000 Israelis went to India. And though on the surface level of dear old Mother India, it's a bit of a nightmare. Those of you, we all know. The pollution, the hassles, the trains, the food, the diarrhea, the malaria, the hepatitis, the sickness, the Delhi belly, all that goes with it. January before last, I arrived at the platform to take the Rajdhani from Delhi to Gaya. It's a 12-13 hour train journey. And arrived there at about 3:30 in the afternoon for the 4:30 train. Most of you know these kind of stories. And then on came the announcement an hour later, we are very sorry to inform you, this train is running 9 hours late. Which, for some of us, was a relief. Well, only 9 hours. It's not like British railways. Anyway. But getting past the outer appearances there, there's some depth of India which many of us love and have learned and continue to learn a great deal from. I think with regard to diet, particularly to vegetarian diet. And some of us who have been to India and have been many times have made a commitment, a vow to ourselves, not to eat anything which has eyes. Animals, birds, or fish. But then one of my dear, clever Dharma friends said, oh, Christopher, then you don't eat potatoes. And then for others of us who have gone, and it's digging a little deeper into spirituality, into exploration of teachings and practices which can be healthy and helpful and actually really insightful for our daily lives. There's a great number of people too travelling from the West there who love the arts, who love creativity and the performing arts, and are learning music and dance and tabla and sarod and sitar. There are people who are going to India to explore community, the sense of ashram life, and very much to find out what's going on inside of ourselves. And sometimes places in different parts of the world are an important reminder for us. And some of you have, as you just saw with the raising of the hands, taking steps away from the norms of our culture and the everyday life, with all the values that it has and all the pluses that we have in our society, but sometimes in various ways it's been important, and it is important, continues to be, to say no to this, no to that, and yes to something else. And in a very small way, but equally important way, being here in the Negev is also stepping out from the known, stepping out from the familiar, your work, your families, your studies, your lifestyle, and moving into an environment which is one of exploration, of silence, which isn't easy in a whole variety of ways, but it's saying no to something in order to say yes to something else. Even though we find it difficult, even though we sit and it's painful, even though we find the struggles of heart, mind and body challenging, and as Stephen was saying, disturbing for us, yet somehow or other, in our willingness to step back from, to step out of, for a period of time, it gives us a kind of opportunity to really get in touch with ourselves. And we shouldn't underestimate how easy and how quickly we can really lose touch with ourselves. And when we do that, we lose the capacity in life to say yes to what's valuable and important, and to say no to what we don't wish to follow through with, or which we don't wish to accept. And sometimes in our life, in this exploration of saying no, it isn't easy. And I hear, as a Dharma teacher, many stories and many accounts, both here and elsewhere, what it is to look inside and to say to oneself, no. You're a woman. You meet somebody. There's some energy there. There's some sense of the romantic there. There's an encounter there. There's an amorous connection there. Deep down, for whatever the reason, you wish to just be a friend with that man. You don't wish to be intimately involved. You don't wish to go to bed with him. But there's some pressure. The man wants to be close. He wants to touch. He wants to feel. He wants to be intimate. And sometimes the voice inside it isn't easy, because the deep down voice is saying, no, I just want to be friends. I just want to have a good friendship with you. And the other voice sometimes can be saying, I need to please, or why not, or whatever. And sometimes when we listen deeply, it isn't easy, and one says no. And that might cost that contact. That might cost that friendship. There may be pressure on you to follow a particular line of work. Perhaps your father did it, perhaps your mother did it, perhaps you're good at it, perhaps it's a career which lots of people around are saying to you, follow this, do this, but your heart's not in it. So you're getting pressure from your peers, pressure from your family, pressure from your educators. But you feel deep down inside there's something else that you want to do with your life, and you don't want to follow that through. And it's not easy again to say no. You have friends. You have a tendency, an addiction towards cocaine. And your friends are taking it. Your peer group is taking it. And you go out one evening and you're having a drink. And then they say to you, why didn't you come? We're having a great party tonight. And you know what that means. You know that the tendency is there, the vulnerability is there, and you're struggling with yourself to say no to cocaine. And you're at that point, and you know if you say, okay, well, I'll be fine, I'll be able to handle it, and you're in the atmosphere, and then you know you haven't got a chance. And there are some points where we know, all of us know, where we're right on the edge with something, and we're asking ourselves, do I have the power inside of me to say no? You don't want to go into the army. The nation state tells you to go into the army. The military tells you to go in the army. The family tells you to go in the army. You're told it's your duty to go into the army. And it's not easy to say, I don't believe in destructive engagement with other human beings. I only believe in constructive engagement. I believe in the power of the word. I don't believe in the power of the rifle. And it's no easy task to keep true to that, to say no, as some of you have done in this hall, and keep the integrity. And there are many issues in life which really challenge us, with all, without exception, and finding this power inside of ourselves to say yes to that which is creative and constructive and deep and meaningful, and to say no to that which is harmful and destructive. And there's not a human being in this hall, none of us, who won't keep facing this kind of situation. It's no easy task to be empowered in life to say no. That's a part of this practice. Sometimes, with the exploration, it isn't always so easy, because there's a kind of pull on the feelings, pull on the connections, pull on the emotions. Just before coming here, we had our Dharma facilitators program, and Itamar very kindly allowed us to use his home. We had these 4 days together exploring and discussing and going into the Dharma. And I was, must have been a bit nostalgic that day. I was remembering with my own good family when I travelled to the East, travelled to India. And at the end of every letter, every aerogram, my mother wrote one every week. And after 2 or 3 weeks, this is in 1967, she would write, when are you coming home? This was always the final sentence. You know what it's like. It was easier in those days. No mobile phones, no faxes, no emails. It was heaven on earth. But these days, they're only a click of the button away. So she would write, when are you coming home? And then after a few weeks, it got reduced to W for the when, A for the R, Y for the you, C for the coming, and H for the home. And I knew what it meant because of it, there. So, after some time, and I was away a little while, 10 years and 10 days to be precise. It's true. So after a little while, I wrote in one of my replies to my good mother and father, what would you prefer? Would you like me working in London as a reporter and unhappy? Because that's what I was doing when I was in England, in London. Or would you prefer me a monk in the forest in Thailand and happy? She wrote back, in London. It's true. So sometimes, when we listen to the inner voice, we stay true to something. We can't explain it to ourselves. We receive letters. Why aren't you coming home? I remember. Your grandmother's died. Why aren't you coming home? Your sister's got engaged. Why aren't you coming home? Your sister's getting married. Why aren't you coming home? Your friends are all asking about you. Why aren't you coming home? You've just become an uncle. Why? Etc. And all over the years, and all the pull there, one is endeavoring to stay true to something. But one's mind can't explain, doesn't quite know why. And even though one knows, as I did with my good mother and father and friends, that one was loved. But sometimes in staying true to something, there's a kind of ethic which goes with it. And some kind of trust, maybe a bit naive, maybe a bit simple. Or some kind of trust that if one stays true to something, it will come together. It will have been the right thing to do and the right thing to follow through. And one trusts that one's heart will tell one when the right time is to make a move or to make a change. And I went into, if I may say, into the monastery. Somebody was asking me today. 6 years as a Buddhist monk in Thailand and India. And one person said to me today, why did you disrobe? And like lots of things in life, when we enter into something and we explore and develop in something, sometimes we don't know how long it will take. We don't know what the commitments are that we are making. And one has to trust in some kind of instinct, some kind of intuition, some kind of feeling the time is right. And I remember the metaphor that came to me just after I disrobe. And the metaphor simply said, inside myself, when the fruit is ripe, it has to leave the tree. And it's not that one sometimes finishes things because it's a problem, or because it's painful, or because one's reacting negatively against it. Sometimes, in any kind of communication, in any kind of relationship, sometimes there is a fulfillment, there is a completion, and we have to move on. And that may mean, for another or others, that it, for them it's a little hard to understand. There will be people in your life, wherever you have come from, who can't comprehend what on earth you are doing here. If you said, oh, I've got a week off, I'm going to rot on the beach in the Sinai, then, oh, wonderful, brilliant, I wish I was going with you. But if one does something a little unusual, a little unfamiliar, and stepping out, it can be hard for others who know us and love us and care for us to comprehend. And some of you may have heard quite persuasive voices saying, oh, it's not very nice. Your knees will hurt. Your mind will wander. No talking, it's abnormal. Must be really strange, etc. And yet, despite the voices, you've listened to yourself. Despite all those voices, sometimes from without and sometimes from within, and said, well, let me see. Let me, as the Buddha said, ehipasiko opanayiko, let me see through my own experience what is valid and worthwhile. Let me see through my own experience. Not through books. And some of you are telling me in the groups, you've read a lot of books. Too much. And some of you have heard from other people, their experiences, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. But in life, life is experience. Without experience, we're second hand. Without experience, we're copying other people. We have to find through the experience, and it's the experience that makes the difference. Nothing else will. There's no substitute for it. I don't know about you, but I remember one of the Buddha's students, one of the Buddha's practitioners. And in the old tradition of India, and it still gets expressed quite a lot, there was a view that pardon me, one's life, I can't quite remember how it flowed, but one's life was essentially in the Brahminical tradition of Hinduism, put into four primary areas. One was birth and being the son and being the daughter, and of course being under the good, hopefully good guidance and support of one's mother and father and family. One then developed in one's life family and work. And then those two areas became two primary areas, all of which are of course important and valuable. And then the fourth one would, one would retire from that and perhaps go to the ashram, meditate, go to the jungle. And this was sometimes interpreted as the four stages of life. And part of the radical voice of the Buddha was in fact saying no to all of that, no to that order, and certainly there's no guarantee that we'll get to old age anyway, but more where we are in the moment to start questioning immediately what is it that really, really matters. And in a retreat, in the silence of the atmosphere, in the reflections that you and I have the opportunity to engage in, it is important what really matters. And one young man started following the teachings, and he said a rather, I regard, memorable one-liner. He started following the Dharma, exploring the teachings, and he looked at where he was coming from, and sometimes we look at our society, we look at our people around us, we look sometimes at our own family, and we look around and we say, my goodness me, the unhappiness, the anger, the fears, the worry, the intensity, the problems, the issues that are going on, that the whole life can seem to be so absorbed in all of this. And one young man said, I've looked at all of that, and he said this memorable one-liner, I have looked at all of that, and I don't want to live like that. I don't want to live a selfish, greedy, angry, negative, demanding person, putting pressure on myself, pressure on others, and pressure on the world that we live in. And so sometimes some of us, in our own small ways, have looked at things and said, I'm going to say no to that. And that moment, or moments in life, is an extraordinary thing to do. Because it's one thing to say, to be clear, what am I saying no to? And it's something else to explore, what am I going to say yes to? What matters? And the following that trust through, exploring all of that, is a major ethic for us. I was having a coffee in my coffee shop. I live in Totnes, in it's in the west country of England. It's known as Britain's New Age capital, which I think is rather nice. Anyway, it's a rather funky town, I have to say. In the alternative bookshop, as you go inside the door, there are over 300 cards and posters advertising everything alternative you can imagine. Everything. Everything. Mind, body, yoga, therapy, counseling, workshop, gurus, advaita, satsang, dharma, meditation, community life, homeopathy, osteopathy, you name it, this is Totnes. there are more generals than soldiers in Totnes, right, in this area. And so I was having a coffee with a friend, and she was telling me that at Gaya House, the retreat center I was a co-founder of, a guy came and sat a weekend retreat. He was in his 30s. He had a business. He owned a house or apartment in London. And he sat the weekend retreat, learnt about insight meditation, vipassana, meditation and sitting and walking, and got the instructions. Went back on the Monday, walked into the estate agent, put his house on the market, went to his office, and it was his office, and said, I'm resigning. I don't know what I'm going to do, but one thing is for sure, I'm not doing what I was. And he closed the business, closed up, and went off to you know where. It's true! And sometimes people just do these things. Those who must think I'm must be being paid by the Indian government by now. I'm not, I promise. I don't do it. So sometimes we take a look. This is what vipassana is about. It's not method. It's not technique. The teachings are to take a really clear look at the immediate of experience to see what can I realize through it. This is called vipassana. To look clearly at an experience, to focus on it, to give it the fullest attention, to see for oneself what is it that I need to see very clearly. This is called vipassana. It is called insight. It is called meditating upon for realization. Supposing some of us who have the privilege of traveling and traveling quite a lot and have much love for people and Mother Earth do feel concerned, and I hope all of us do here as well, at the kind of arrogance and conceit that permeates our society. And we are told, and it puts it up there in a kind of metaphysical way, and I feel rather abstract way, we say, we live in the free world. Please. Free world, please. And sometimes when we look around and we say, is this the free world? All this unhappiness, depression, insecurity, domestic violence, food, cigarette, alcohol, addiction, is this what living in the free world is? Is this what we're trying to impose on the other peoples of the earth? Is this what free world is? And sometimes we look and we say, this isn't the free world. This is narcissism. Does everybody know the word? Ariana? Everybody knows, she says. She knows you all, so everybody. Narcissism. It's a kind of self-preoccupation. Just thinking about myself. Nothing else counts. There. And sometimes when we look at this, we say, well, what is three of the biggest values we have in our society? One is ownership. the pursuit of goods, the pursuit of items, to have. Another big, huge one is the pursuit of information. We are information mad. Computers, books, newspapers, magazines. I was in the railway station at Bodmin Railway Station. They have a newspaper, magazine. I did a rough count. And just up top, and then just multiplied by the number of shelves. More than 2,000 publications in the news and magazine shop on Bonn Railway Station. So, freedom in our society says pursue goods, things, pursue more knowledge, and get status. Be somebody. This is called freedom. Some of us have a different word for it. It's called the nightmare. And sometimes we look at our day, we look at the flow of our life, and we say, in my life, do I have the capacity as a human being making this extraordinary journey through existence to actually consider that which is outside of the pursuit of goods, the pursuit of information, and the pursuit of position? Because once you and I start to question all of that, we threaten the status quo. It's a radical question. But it might bring out of us love and respect and integrity and inner empowerment. And we know we haven't sold out. Because the model that you and I have been given, goods, information and personal position, is so destructive, so harmful to people, to our resources, to our animals, to each other. And so when we speak of participating in a retreat, it's not just to have go home with a little calmness which will finish as you enter into Tel Aviv. It's not just to be able to watch a few breaths come and go. It's to see. It's to look. It's to take an interest in this extraordinary experience of life. One of you asked Simi, made me smile, I love it. She said, when does Vipassana begin? Somebody asked Simi. It began when we got here. So let me just speak for a few minutes about this. In the tradition, and in the Buddha's teachings, he uses the word Vipassana, and the simple English translation is insight. It's a really perfect complementary translation. So though it is often referred to as insight meditation or Vipassana meditation, more precisely it's a meditation for insight, to see into. And one of the features of that in our practice is to be more inside. How often we lose our authority, we lose our inner power, and we lose our integrity because we're so easily pulled out of ourselves. Running around after this, that and the other, pulled out by circumstances. And we can feel, as one person was saying, that she hadn't been in a retreat for a couple of years. Just coming into the Dharma hall, just sitting for 10 or 15 minutes, immediately begin to appreciate and realize what it is to be back with oneself, back in touch with oneself, back grounded in one's experience. It's a difficult thing, yes, it's a challenging thing, and how easily we can spend our whole life escaping from ourselves. What a loss. And as the Buddha commented on this, no matter where you and I go in this world, one thing is for sure, our mind goes with us. Everywhere. There's no escape. So, since the inner life, is the instrument by which we have a relationship with the world, it's the only instrument that we have. If we're not happy and healthy inside, if we don't have a sense of well-being inside, nothing out there will make us happy. Because the only way we can look at something is through the vehicle called the heart and the feelings and the perceptions and the thoughts. And some of you, we know, are in extremely challenging situations. People here attending and dealing with cancer. There are people here whose marriages have just fallen apart. There are people here in a period of life of great unknown and indecision. There are people here who are dealing with crises in other people's lives and desperately trying to give them support. And sometimes when men and women come together in a situation like this to look into situations and attend to it, often we have no idea of what the person is dealing with who is sitting next to us. And everybody, all of us, we have our story. All of us are having to deal and attend to various areas of our life. And so when some difficult experience is arising, it's one thing to look at it. But sometimes we have to ask, what is it I really need to be very clear about? And please don't be shy of asking yourself that kind of question. What do I really need to understand here? What do I need to realize about this? One person in the small group commented, two things I notice with life. One is, there are things in life which I have to accept. And the other is, there are things in life which I have to change. Sometimes we get them the wrong way round. Sometimes we accept our unhappiness, our moodiness, our irritability, our disappointments, instead of saying, hey, this can be changed. Sometimes we refuse to accept what has to be accepted. Somebody loves us and says, shalom, au revoir, goodbye, I found somebody else, grass is greener on their side of the fence. You can be the Buddha of the Buddhas. It won't get the person back. He or she has gone. We've all known this one. All the reactivity, all the arguing, all the protest, all the possessiveness, all the jealousy, doesn't make a scrap of difference to the fact. The fact is, it has to be accepted. And everything else is denial. So there are times in our life when the wisdom of the human being is the acknowledgement and the recognition of what has to be accepted. my Ajahn Buddhadasa, my old teacher, lived in the forest for well over 60 years. Extraordinary human being. Would start off some of his talks with, I think, a great one, very Buddhist, but a great one-liner. He would start off his talks, "Dear brothers and sisters, in birth, aging, pain and death." Whoa. Whoa, wait a minute. This is also part of the process of life. We can't start off at death and go back to birth. We can't change the order. It's just life is birth and aging, pain, but much more to it than just that. In the day, how am I flying? A couple of minutes. I'm in a roll, I could go on, but I read once that the attention span for listening is around 40 minutes. I'm just exhausting it. All right. Sometimes, in the meditation, there are each of the postures. Our life is spent sitting, walking, standing and reclining. It's not a unique experience. But there is a kind of quality that of attention that we can bring to it. And the important thing with attention or mindfulness or meditation is that it contributes to seeing a little bit more clearly. But that means as well that in our silences and in our stillnesses, though we may see more clearly, we may see what we don't want to see. It's not like there's choice. Though our consumer culture has an obsession, an ideological obsession with choice, when we walk through that door onto our cushion, choice inwardly, what? We sit, we close our eyes, we put our hands together. God knows what's going to happen. There is no guarantee of what the experience will be. It could be harmonious and concentrated and deep and profound. And it could be like there's a volcano going on. And as one person said, she'd been doing her yoga, committed to her yoga, which I think yoga and meditation go together like bread and butter. I'm a very big fan of yoga. And that then comes in to sit. And then in coming to sit, flows of tears. Why? Where did they all suddenly emerge from? What is it that brings about the emotion which flows, and when it comes out from up here, it comes out as dropped, as water? Have you ever? I've never understood why feelings convert to water. If you have an explanation, Hari Om. So we come in to sit. And part of our innocence and our humility as a human being is that the last sitting is no indicator for the next. The beginning of the sitting is no indicator for the end, nor the middle. We live in a life, an extraordinary life, where if we put hand on heart, we do not know what's going to be happening 5 minutes from now. We do not know how we're going to be feeling 3 minutes from now. We do not know how we're going to be thinking 10 minutes from now. We live in a life where what we know is so extraordinary little, and we live in extraordinary unknowingness. It's an incredible thing. Every time you and I come, every time I walk in here, I have no idea what this sitting will be like. And I've been doing it my whole adult life. I don't know. How could I? I don't know what thought will arise, what the attention will go to. I may say, oh, I wish to be with the breath. Oh, I wish to stay with the body, whatever. And hopefully, usually, it does. But sometimes it likes to go somewhere else, and then it comes back. And one just gets to know and rather love the extraordinary inner universe in its unfoldment. Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, is to see clearly. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings have the power to say no, what one needs to say no to. And may all beings have the power to say yes, what needs to be said yes to. Okay. Let's have a couple of quiet minutes, shall we?